Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears along with you here on this Tuesday, February the 2nd, 2021. Groundhog Day, 15 minutes past the hour, and we should say right off the bat, we have a great guest, first of all, this hour, so don't change the dial. We're going to learn a lot about the pandemic and the vaccine, and it's a first-time visitor to this program, so we are very excited to get to him. But a little bit of housekeeping we have to do here this morning. Of course, here in Marion, groundhogs are very important to us. 41 years ago, legendary broadcaster Charlie Evers, who was on this station for the last 6 years of his broadcast career, right up through April the 8th of last year, created this tradition 41 years ago. Chuck is actually named after Charlie Evers. If you're all wondering, about an hour ago, Buckeye Chuck, let me get this right, I always get this wrong, so I got to get the paper here. Buckeye Chuck did not see his shadow, which means spring is around the corner, and I got that word this morning from Jeannie, Charlie Evers' widow. So, our wife, however you want to say that. So thanks, Jeannie, for sending that information in. And Buckeye Chuck did not see his shadow, which means spring is around the corner. And like this has happened so many times, if you wonder, the most famous groundhog in the world, Pugsatoni Phil, did see his shadow. So they do disagree. Pugsatoni Phil says spring is not around the corner. But we're going to go with Buckeye Chuck and say that spring is around the corner, certainly in deference to Charlie. Now, also want to thank the Marion Star. The Marion Star did a great article yesterday on the front page about the interview we did with Mayor Scott Schertzer. I thank them for giving us credit for that interview. Marion Star continues to do a great job getting the news out here in Marion, so I thank them for that. And now we turn to our guest, who I am very excited to have on the program. We've had Marion Public Health Commissioner Tracy Kinsler on pretty much every week or every other week since the beginning of the pandemic back in March of 2020. This day, for this hour, we have a first-time guest, hopefully not a last time, to fill us in on some of the things about the vaccine, the pandemic, and all kinds of things going on in the world of medicine. He is Dr. Michael McLeese, the medical director at Marion Public Health. Dr. McLeese, how are you?
I'm good, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Good to speak with you. For people who don't know, what does the medical director at Marion Public Health do?
So my job is really to advise Tracy and the board on different medical topics. Obviously, right now things are dominated by the COVID-19 pandemic, but I'm basically there as a medical professional and advisor to help the Board of Public Health and Tracy carry out the great work that they do every day.
Now, as far as a doctor here in Marion, what is your specialty? What is your practice?
I am an internal medicine specialist. I do primary care. I'm with Ohio Health, so I practice out of the Smith Clinic building.
Internal medicine, what kind of things do you see in that field?
So I see all types of, I only do adults, so general adult medicine, but I see all types of complaints. I mean, I do primary care, so everything from scrapes, bumps, and bruises to heart issues, to diabetes, to hypertension. I kind of cover it all.
Does it stay busy all the time? So many people have medical issues these days and living longer.
Oh yeah, we are very busy now more than ever. But Marion is a great community, and it's great to be able to take care of the people of Marion. We're busy. We do a lot. We're obviously part of Ohio Health, so we do. I have multiple other primary care doctors that we're all very busy doing the best we can to help take care of people and keep people healthy.
Dr. McLeese, since that week in March, early March of 2020, when this pandemic hit, what has it been like for a primary care physician to just continue to operate?
It's It's been a very interesting year, to say the least. Things have changed quickly, especially early on. We really didn't know a whole lot. Things were rapidly changing. We were learning new things every day. I know early on, kind of in our practice, we basically shut down for a while. We wanted to keep people out of the office, keep people safe, doing a lot of virtual telehealth visits. As we've learned, and as we've had more testing, we've been able to open back up and still make sure that we take care of the health of other people, because just because the pandemic's out there doesn't mean that other health issues don't arise and need to be taken care of. So we've done a really good job of opening back up, but still utilizing telehealth virtual visits, which is kind of a new frontier for medicine. So that's been the biggest rapid change and adjustment is going from the traditional office visit to utilizing different technologies to help deliver health care in a safe and practical way for people.
Doing these virtual visits, has it made life easier or harder?
Overall, I think it's made it easier. It's easier, certainly easier and more convenient for the patients. They don't have to leave their home, especially when we have weather like this. We can do a lot of virtual visits and keep people safe and off the road. Also, lowers any risk of exposure that may be out there. So, overall, I think it's made life easier. Now, there's certain things that we just need to see in the office, and if we come across those, we can say, hey, we really need to have you come in. But all in all, I think it's made things easier, more convenient, which allows more people to have access to the healthcare system, which is ultimately a great thing.
You know, Dr. McLeese, I want to ask you this before we get to the pandemic, because there's a lot to do with that I want to get into. But when it comes to hypertension, high blood pressure, is there any theory as to why so many people suffer from this? It causes so many other illnesses, heart attacks, strokes, just bad circulation throughout your body. Are we more nervous? Are we more stressed? Are we eating the wrong foods? Has something changed? Are we just living longer and it just happens?
I think it's kind of all of the above. When we talk about hypertension, it's what we call in medicine a multifactorial disease, meaning there's not one specific thing that we can point to that causes it. Certainly we know that things like diet and exercise, obesity, can all contribute, smoking. These are all things, and certainly, yes, the longer people live, the more we're going to find some of these illnesses that we may not have discovered hundreds of years ago when people just didn't live that long. But there's also a genetic component to hypertension, and there are some family history is something that we can't necessarily control, but that can play a big role in hypertension as well. So it's really lots of different causes. Some that we can modify and some that we can't. So it's all about kind of doing the best we can to modify some of the things that we can control, and then doing effective treatment strategies, whether that be either medication or not medication. Diet and exercise is always the number one treatment for hypertension. So there's lots of different causes and lots of different treatments for it.
Just a little bit of a crossover into the pandemic here, but when it comes to hypertension, because I had talked to a psychiatrist about this early on in the pandemic, and he was really worried about all the people who are now working from home, who normally would not be working from home, and fearful that it might stay that way after the pandemic and increase the idea that people will not go out of the house, that people will not get exercise every day that they normally would going to the office. Now, of course, his was from a psychological standpoint. Is there any worry about that from a medical standpoint?
There is. We certainly want people, both from a mental health and a physical health standpoint, there's a concern, especially this winter when people really don't have the ability to get outside and do much. I think both physical health and mental health can take a little bit of a hit. But in my experience, I've seen that people are ready to get outside, and whether that just be outside doing outside activities safely, people are ready to just get out of the house and do just about anything. So I think we can harness that and really encourage people to get outside and live those healthy lifestyles while still keeping themselves safe as it relates to the pandemic. I'm very looking forward to the spring where the weather starts to open up, people can get outside and do some of the exercise and other things to keep themselves healthy. So it's certainly a worry. It's something that we talk about every day. But I think especially after this pandemic, people are going to be, once it's safe, people are going to be ready to get out and try to get back to a little bit of normalcy.
When we talk about this pandemic, the three words we always hear on the news, in newspapers, radio, whatever it is, internet, it's pandemic, it's coronavirus, and it's COVID-19. From a medical perspective, as much as you can, describe what is this illness? What happens?
So the technical medical term for the virus itself is SARS-CoV-2. And that's the scientific name for the virus. Now, the disease that virus causes is what we call coronavirus disease 19, shortened commonly to COVID-19. Coronaviruses in general are respiratory viruses. There are four or five out in the environment normally that cause a common cold that most likely everybody listening to this have been exposed to in the past. This new novel, we call novel coronavirus, is a variant, is a within the same family, but a different type of virus within the same family that is new to human immune systems, and thus has caused a more severe illness than some of the other coronaviruses. Now, because it's new, our bodies do not have immunity to it. We've seen it spread rapidly across the world, starting in China and then in Europe and now global, and that's where the whole pandemic thing is. It's a global disease that is spread very quickly. So that's kind of a little bit of the science and the background and some of the technical terms of what we're dealing with.
You know, this is still coming up 11 months in, so I want to address it here. So many people believe that when you tell people the numbers, because we get the numbers all the time, about how many people have died in the county, how many people are sick in the county, in the state, in the country, and they say, well, what are the flu numbers? What are the flu numbers? They're just as bad. They have been just as bad. Why is this different than the flu?
This seems to cause an immune response in somebody that is much more severe, and that's what leads to hospitalizations, a severe drop in oxygen levels that ultimately in some patients require the use of a ventilator and what causes people to pass away from this. We don't really know why this virus causes that reaction just yet. We're still learning, and we don't know for sure. But coronavirus is a different type of virus from the flu, and part of it is influenza tends to affect even much older people than we're seeing affect the coronavirus. So we're seeing more people in their 50s and 60s that have severe illness due to the coronavirus. When we look through the numbers in a normal year, there may be 30 to 40,000 deaths nationwide in the country from influenza. And we're coming up on a year, and I believe last check we were about at 250,000 deaths nationwide. So unfortunately, the reality of the situation is that coronavirus, as far as numbers go, causes more severe illness than we even see with the flu.
When it comes to the illness itself, not saying that the flu can have long-term effects, but so many people now, I believe there have even been support groups created for this, are feeling the effects long after the virus is gone. They still have trouble breathing. They still have fatigue. They still are getting headaches. Do we know why that's happening yet, or are we just going to have to study this?
Yeah, we really don't know for sure. We know that some people that develop the more severe illness end up in the hospital or in the ICU. It can cause such a reaction to the lungs that there's actually scarring of the lungs that starts to form, and that can cause long-term breathing issues. But as far as some of the other symptoms, fatigue, these kind of persistent symptoms, loss of taste and smell, we still aren't for sure why exactly that happens. And that's something as a medical community that we're very aware of, and we're working to support these people and also try to learn as much as possible to hopefully develop treatments down the road to help them.
I understand, Dr. McLeese, that nothing is probably precise here because we are so young in this illness. But if you got coronavirus, if you got COVID-19, tested positive, and had scarring to your lungs and continued with a breathing issue, is there a point to where your lungs do heal? Do your lungs heal up from scarring like that?
Usually, if you get to the point that it's been several months after the infection and you have scarring, the scarring itself can be is more of a permanent process. Now, that doesn't mean that the other parts of the lung can't heal up and recover. And there are lots of people that have scarring from other issues that end up having no symptoms. They breathe normally. The lungs are pretty resilient organs, so even if part of them have scarring or long-term issues, the other parts of the lung can compensate, and what a patient ends up feeling may not be that different from their normal breathing pattern.
You know, I think a lot of terms have gotten thrown around in this pandemic, and one of those is 2 weeks. We hear a quarantine is 2 weeks. We hear the run of the virus is 2 weeks. But would the effects, the breathing issues, the fatigue and all of that, even though it might go on longer than 2 weeks, even though it might go on several months, as people are indicating, is there still a chance it could go away?
Certainly, we see improvements, and we can see people over time with either medications or therapy. We can see improvements, and the hope is that people can kind of recover fully, even if there is evidence of scarring in their lungs. But that kind of the 2 week mark where we talk about quarantine, that really refers to the ability to spread the virus. So we know that. The initial phase of the illness, when you contract the virus and you have initial symptoms, that's where you're able to spread the virus to others, and that's why the quarantine period is so important. After that two-week period, if people continue to have symptoms, then that's more related to their immune response to the virus. Once even the virus itself has kind of been cleared from their body, then the secondary immune response sets in that causes inflammation and scarring of the lungs. That doesn't necessarily mean that the virus can still be spread, but the lingering effects of the virus are causing damage that we try to use different treatments to help control as best we can, and then long term, again, we're still figuring out the best ways to treat these people because we don't know a whole lot about it yet. It's been around about a year, and in the medical field, that's not a lot of time. So ongoing research and study is going, how do we best help these people going forward so they can live long, full, and healthy lives?
Why is this so contagious? Is it more contagious, or is it just harder on people, and we think of it that way?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think part of the contagious factor is this is something that nobody's ever been exposed to before. So it's a respiratory virus that can spread easily in close contact, and because our immune systems have never been exposed to it before, that can make it very easy for people to get sick. So it's a little bit of both. It's easier to spread, and then like I said, with that immune response and how people respond, that can be cause more significant illness than even some of the other viruses out there that we encounter all the time.
there has been a lot to do with masks, and I think that probably goes back to the beginning when people said, don't wear masks, that's not going to help, and then there was this idea that if you wear a mask, you can't transmit the illness, but people can still give it to you, and then eventually it was said that no, it not only helps the other person, it helps you from getting it. What is the story on the mask?
So I think early on, a lot of the concerns, I mean, we've always known that masks can prevent viruses. When somebody has the flu in the hospital, we wear masks in the room and to protect themselves and to protect others. I think the reason that there was some hesitancy early on to have the general public use masks was more of a supply. We wanted to make sure that the healthcare workers, people that were sick, people that were being exposed, workers in long-term care facilities had the appropriate amount of personal protective equipment to be able to protect themselves and protect the most vulnerable patients. So I don't think, and you may have heard a lot, but the goal was never that masks don't do anything. It was we need to make sure we have enough masks to make sure that our hospitals and nursing homes have those abilities. And then going forward, the more we learned about it, yes, the highest benefit comes from if you wear a mask, you are less likely to spread the virus. But that doesn't mean that the mask cannot also protect you from getting the virus from somebody else. And that's why it's so important that if everybody wears a mask, it lowers the risk of somebody spreading it and also getting it. And we really see that if two people are wearing masks, the risk of transmission is very low because it does provide that double layer of protection.
So why is it that if you wear a mask and have it, it's hard to spread it, but if somebody else has it who doesn't have a mask on and you have one on, you can still get it?
So because the masks that we use in the general public, they're not 100%. They don't form a perfect seal around the mouth and the nose. So if you still have the virus and are spreading it, there's some air that's going to leak out and not be protected by the mask. And then if somebody else is close to you not wearing a mask, then that can increase the risk of them getting it. And that's why it's important that we all wear masks, because we know that people are able to spread the virus about a day or two before they come symptomatic. So you can be spreading the virus without having any symptoms. So if people wear their masks and we do that pretty consistently, then you both protect yourself if you could possibly have it and spread it to other people. But you could also then protect yourself if you're around somebody that may be spreading the virus. But masks, they're not 100%, but they do a really good job, and that's why it's not just masks, but social distancing, hand washing, all of those things together. If we do all of those, we greatly, greatly reduce the risk of transmitting this virus.
One thing that was of high interest at one point was washing your hands with soap and warm water and using antibacterial soap. We don't talk so much about that anymore. Is this still a good idea, and how often should we be doing this?
It's in general, yes. Hand washing with warm water and soap is an excellent idea, not just for this virus, but for any infectious disease. It lowers the risk. And what I recommend to people, any time that you may be out in public, you're touching different surfaces, you're having close interactions before you eat, after you go to the bathroom, these are all great times to wash your hands. Because it's important to know that these measures work for all infectious diseases. They're obviously important for the coronavirus because of the current pandemic, but they help lower the risk of transmitting any other bacteria or virus.
In your opinion, because we are 11 months into this, why is it that the United States has had a much bigger problem than most any other country with this?
That's a hard question to answer. I think in general, Americans love their freedom and don't necessarily like to be told what to do, and I think and like to do some of their social activities, and that it's been a big change and a big adjustment that happened very rapidly. This is not something that we were prepared for. So it's and Americans are a very diverse population. We're not a small European country. We're it's a very large very large country. There's people that live in urban settings and rural settings. So I think trying to come up with a cohesive plan and getting everybody on board with that has been a bit of a challenge. I think as people have learned about it and have seen their friends and family members get sick, people have recognized that this is something that we need to take seriously, and we've seen improvements over time with some of those things.
On that note, Dr. McLeese, before we move on to the vaccine here, when this all started in March, and we did have the biggest shutdown we have had during this 11-month period that went on through late May of last year, people were staying home, people were definitely cautious, and the numbers were relatively low. We had one person die here in Marion County, and it stayed that way for a long, long time into this illness, until we had the prison outbreak. But as fall came, sports started to be played again on the high school level, on the college level, on the pro level. Then we had the holidays, and people were very much more aware at that point about what it does, the contagiousness. The mask mandate was in place. We even had a curfew that started before Thanksgiving and Christmas, and the numbers got to an all-time high. How do you coalesce that as a doctor?
So I think we experienced some complacency with things. We saw that the measures were working. We were excited about the numbers getting better. And naturally, when people hear that the numbers are getting better, things are getting better, people started to do more things. And then once the winter came, you're right, there was a lot of the activities and things that could be done outside in the summer. Can't be done as the weather starts to turn, and that's why, in general, most viruses and flu get worse in the winter, because we're forced to do more things inside. So I think in the summer we had people that were maybe doing more get-togethers and things, but they were doing them safer in an outside setting. And then as the weather changed, Buckeye football came back and things moved inside. I think that's part of where we saw the big explosion of cases, because we really know from the data through the health department and even some of the statewide and nationwide data, these cases aren't driven by spread within our hospitals or even our schools. It's really the individuals getting together in homes outside of their bubble, and that's really what contributed to the spread that we saw early on in the winter.
We had not, now moving on to the vaccine for our last 18 minutes here, when this all started back in March of 2020, we had 9 months where there really was no vaccine for anybody. And then very late last year, early this year, the vaccine started to become available to first responders, people who work in the medical profession, very elderly people in nursing homes. And we found out that after all this time, I don't know what the numbers were, but people decided they weren't going to get the vaccine. Did that surprise you?
It didn't. It didn't. I know that a lot of people, anytime there's something new, there's a lot of hesitancy out there. And I think people should do their own research and should be skeptical and aware of what they put in their body. And also, unfortunately, there was a lot of misinformation out there about the vaccine that swayed some people. So it was a bit disappointing seeing the numbers. I think as things go on, I've personally noticed that really among healthcare workers and our elderly that we're populating now, the enthusiasm, the vaccine is much higher than the general population. And a lot of people that I've talked to that are younger, that may not be eligible or be able to get the vaccine for another few months, they're they're not necessarily completely anti-vaccine. They just want to see how things go, and that's perfectly reasonable. But I think we will show with time, and we've shown with some of the research already, and as we vaccinate more and more of the population, that this is a safe vaccine, this is an effective vaccine. And really, the thing that I tell people is, when all this started, everybody's question was, how does this end? How do we get past this? And the vaccine is our greatest tool of how we get past this. The more people we can vaccinate, it lowers the spread within the community. And ultimately, if we get enough people protected, then spread would ultimately stop. So that's really where we're at with the vaccine, and it's our job as the medical profession and the medical community to educate our patients and make sure that they have the correct information, and that they understand that this is a safe, effective vaccine, and it can really protect you and your family members.
That has been one of the long-term questions, because people see that it's not approved by the FDA. They see that obviously it was put together in under a year, and we really can't look and see what it does to people long-term, because it hasn't been there long-term. So to help people's minds rest from a doctor, why is it okay to get this? Why is it not going to do anything but protect you from COVID-19?
Well, first of all, we know that, based on, let me address kind of how it was developed first. So while, yes, this came out faster than any vaccine we've ever had, that was because the government allowed multiple steps to be done at once. Under normal circumstances, when vaccines are developed, it starts with phase one trials, then goes to phase two, then phase three, then it gets approved, and then the vaccine gets manufactured. What Operation Warp Speed, put in by the federal government, allowed was multiple steps to occur at the same time. So phase one and phase two were done simultaneously. Then phase three was done, and we actually started manufacturing the vaccine months before it was authorized by the FDA. And while it doesn't have full FDA approval, it does have FDA emergency use authorization, and was still reviewed by the same vaccination and immunization committees that vaccines normally get approved by. So while the terminology is slightly different, all of the same steps were followed in its development, and it was approved by all of the regulatory agencies and that normally approve vaccines. And as for the long-term effects, but we know that the vaccine itself, at least the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine that are out right now, there's basically four main components to it. There's some sugar, there's some salt, there's a kind of a envelope that protects the vaccine itself made of fats, and then there's the vaccine particle, which is an mRNA particle, which is something that in different variations we have all in our bodies already. So this is a vaccine technology that's actually been around for many, many years, and has been studied for other things, that was just applied to the coronavirus. So because we know the components and we know how this vaccine works, it does not affect an individual's DNA, that it is likely, and we can't say for sure until time passes, but it's very likely that there will be no long-term effects from this vaccine.
If you get both vaccinations, does it mean at that point you can stop wearing your mask, you can give somebody a hug, you can get within 6 feet, you can shake somebody's hand?
Not quite yet. So we know that the main thing that the vaccine was initially designed for, and we know that it's the best at, is preventing moderate to severe illness. And this is very similar to how most vaccines work. The flu vaccine it does a really good job of not necessarily preventing somebody from getting the flu, but preventing the more severe illness that require hospitalization or potentially be life-threatening. Now, we know the vaccine also does a very good job at preventing symptomatic infection, meaning infection to the point where you start to have symptoms. What we don't know for sure, and what we're continuing to research, and hopefully we'll have more information in the coming months, is does the vaccine prevent asymptomatic spread? Meaning, if I have the vaccine, am I still able to transmit the virus, even if I don't have symptoms? And that's what we don't know for sure yet. Until we have more information, I still recommend to people that we wear our masks and social distance and maintain those precautions just to make sure, just to be on the safe side. And then ultimately, once enough of the population is vaccinated and protected, then the virus itself will stop spreading through the community, and that's where we could possibly start to lift some of the mask requirements and do some more of those other things. But for right now, it certainly hasn't changed the way that I function, both in my professional and private life. And we still don't know enough to say for sure whether you can't spread it. But there's ongoing research right now, and I'm hopeful in the next month or two that we'll have some more information on how well does this vaccine prevent asymptomatic spread.
In the circle that I travel in, I know three people fairly well who have gotten the vaccine. One was 90 years old and said there were no symptoms and just a little pain in the arm. The other person, I believe, was in their 80s and really had no symptoms at all. And then somebody who was a healthcare worker who was in their late 30s had a weekend of tiredness, nausea, headache. Is there any rhyme or reason to the side effects of the vaccine?
We don't really know why some people get side effects and some don't. We know from the studies that it's actually younger people that tend to be more prone to having some of those side effects from the vaccine. We don't necessarily know 100% sure why that is. We still know that they studied antibody levels, and there's still an immune response regardless of age. But why some people have those side effects, we don't know for sure.
How nervous do we still need to be, or I guess maybe precautious is the word, how precautious do we still need to be about this if a portion of the population is not getting it and maybe never will at the, or maybe not this year? Are we ever going to see the day where the partitions come down, where we can sit next to a booth at somebody at a restaurant? Is that going to happen this year, the way things are going in the first 2 months?
It's still too early to tell. I know the vaccine rollout has not been as quick as we had hoped. I'm hoping that things will pick up, and it really depends on the amount of vaccine that becomes available, the amount of people that take the vaccine, and then we will, based on that, we'll see how our case numbers start to come down in hospitalizations. As far as some of the precautions, I think some of those things, and rightfully so, that are less intrusive, that don't kind of affect us a whole lot, may be here to stay just for precautions. Some of the glass partitions, if we can take extra precautions and keep people safe, those may be around for a little longer. But I think as the vaccine rolls out and as more people get vaccinated, we're going to see case numbers decline. The question is just how quickly can we get that done?
1918 was the last pandemic. Did anybody ever think there was going to be another one who was in the medical profession? Did we think that we've got so technical, medicine has advanced so far, that this just can't happen again?
No, there's actually been a lot of people in the medical community that have been saying for years and years that it's not if, but when something like this was going to happen. So there are certainly people that are not, that were not taken by surprise, I think, especially as society has evolved. We have much more air travel, much more intercontinental overseas travel. I don't think within the medical community, I think a lot of people were worried and concerned about this threat, and have tried to sound the alarm. Now, trying to get to prepare for that, there's a lot of investment, there's a lot of money involved, and sometimes trying to prepare for a theoretical threat can be harder to get everybody on board for. But this is something that the medical community has been worried about for a while.
Do we think that this, you know, oddly enough, when something happens in 1918, really, even if people were alive then, they don't remember it. Is this something that's not going to happen in our lifetime again because we are so aware of it now and how it changed us? Or could it happen in another couple years?
I'm hopeful that this will open a lot of people's eyes to the importance of monitoring, preparing, and being aware that this could happen. I'm hopeful that this will allow people to prepare better on a national level and on a local level, and just being more aware of the possibility that this could happen again. I think now that we are aware of that, we can take steps to prepare ourselves as a society to lower that risk. But I don't think we can say for 100% sure that this won't ever happen again, but I think it's something that we need to be aware of and we need to be prepared for, so if something does start to develop like this, we can catch it early, put measures in place to stop it in its tracks before it becomes a worldwide global pandemic.
With about 4 minutes left, do we know why it affects people so differently? You know, we've had outbreaks, I guess they've been called, in nursing homes and in prisons and in places of that nature, where some people die, some people don't get symptoms at all, and we would imagine it's been spread probably by the same person in a confined area like that, or at least started in the same place.
Yeah, and that's the scary thing about it, is we really don't know why some people get really sick and why some people don't. Because I've had, personally, I've seen younger, healthy people that have gotten really sick, and I've had patients of my own that are older, have multiple medical conditions, and gotten the virus and ended up doing well. So we know that there's certain things, such as obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, history of heart disease, some of these other underlying medical conditions can increase the risk for having more severe illness. But on an individual level, we still don't know why exactly two people may react very differently to the virus.
Two quick questions here, because this has been a big one. If you have it, can you get it again?
So we know that the natural infection of the virus does appear to give some immunity. Now, how long that lasts, we don't know for sure. And certainly there have been more and more reports as we get into this of people getting it a second time. So the short answer is yes, you can get it again. And that's why even people that have had the virus vaccination is important, because it appears that the vaccine gives a longer lasting immunity than a natural infection would. So, yes, it does appear that people can get it again. Within what time frame is probably going to be a little different for every person. But it is possible to get it a second time.
In the beginning, if you got diagnosed, it was very scary, even if you were asymptomatic. In the last 11 months, has treatment gotten better? Are more people being saved today because of treatment than they were then? And if so, what is the treatment?
I think we've gotten a little better. We do have some treatments that we use a medicine in the hospital called dexamethasone, which is a pretty common steroid. We found that can help. The medication called remdesivir, it does seem to provide some benefit of shortening hospitalizations. We've been using the convalescent plasma, which is taking plasma from people that have recovered from the coronavirus to give to people that are currently have the infection to hopefully slow down their illness. And we've also learned some things as far as kind of how we manage these patients in the hospital, whether at what time do we put them on the ventilator or try to keep them off of the ventilator. As we've learned things, I think we've done a better job of treating these people in the hospital. But we still don't have, it's not like a bacterial infection. We still don't have a specific antibiotic that cures this. There's unfortunately still a lot of people that we do all of that, and they still can have very serious illness and pass away from it. So we've certainly got better at treating it, but we still don't have a cure, and it's still important to the best way to prevent serious illness is to try to prevent yourself from getting the infection in the first place.
Final question with 30 seconds left. As a doctor, what is being in the middle of this at this point, what's your biggest fear in regard to this pandemic?
My biggest fear is that people will just forget over time what this is like and what we went through and the hardships that we all had to suffer as a part of this. And like we talked about with whether this could happen again, I think remembering what we went through, remembering those that we've lost to this virus, remembering the serious other health effects, the financial effects, that's my biggest fear, is that over time we forget those things and that increases the risk of this happening again.
Mm. Dr. Michael McLeese, Medical Director at Marion Public Health, it's been a fascinating conversation this morning. I hope you come back with us in the future, Dr. McLeese.
Anytime. I appreciate it, Scott.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Dr. Michael McLeese coming back in 15 minutes with more program.
Isn't that nice to me? And, boy, I'll never be able to repay it. It's just been wonderful.
Well, I tell you, you've been nice to me. You're one of my favorite interviews.